Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Today on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She's the Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor, and we're going to be talking about this current legislative session and what it can mean to small businesses and businesses altogether here in the great state of Maine. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, you know, there's nothing going on in the state and the Department of Labor, I'm sure, so you're here for no purpose, right?
Right. It's very quiet.
Very
state government's
quiet.
Not working
well,
on anything.
I know better because we have a new legislative session.
Yep.
And there's an awful lot of bills coming out, not only from legislators, but from the governor's office and the Department of Labor.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about those today.
And
so I think that's, let's start with that. But before we get into the bills, before we start with that, tell me a little about what you're seeing as some of the trends that are happening at the Department of Labor, some of the things that's going on. I know we had the commissioner on a couple weeks ago. She talked about general things. But tell me what you're seeing happening in terms of communications and operations.
Well, you know, every winter is our peak time for unemployment filing. And so this winter we have implemented some improvements to our unemployment system, and those have in particular taken place in what we call the new web portal, which is a new website front end to make it easier for individuals to file and manage their claim, change their address, do all of those kinds of account updates using the internet. We also still have a telephone system where you can file by punching the buttons on your phone as well. So we have a couple different options for folks who need to file. But in the upgrade that we've done, one of the things we have focused on is making sure that we have a way to help people register with their employment service, which is a federal and state requirement of unemployment. If you are on unemployment, you must be registered with us so that we can help you look for work. In Maine, the way we do that is a registration with the Maine Job Bank. So that's been a big effort over December, January, and February to messaging to claimants, helping them understand the new requirement when it was going to be implemented, which ended up being the beginning of February, and then helping them do that registration, get access to computers, know how to use email in a job search. I think that sounds unbelievable to some people that someone might not have an email address and not know how to use email properly in applying for jobs and apply for jobs online. But that's really one of the benefits of this change in the unemployment system is that we're helping bring everyone along. If you're filing for unemployment, then you need to be using email and you need to be looking for work.
Well, you know, it's true. There are still individuals who don't use online. Either they refuse to, or they have not necessarily grasped the technology. And this isn't all generational, but it's heavily generational in
yes.
terms of age and demographics. But there certainly are some challenges to that. Are there workarounds? I just think it's important for people. Are there workarounds if somebody really can't?
We have. We will always accommodate, for example, a disability if people have a difficulty. If it's an access issue, we're encouraging people to kind of get out of their routine. If they normally file for unemployment by the phone on Sunday morning, they may need to go to a career center. They may need to go to their public library to get the computer access because the job bank is something you need to access either via a computer hooked to the internet or some kind of wireless device like a tablet or a smartphone.
So the other thing that you mentioned as we talked off air was this new Workforce Data Quality Initiative,
WDQI, yes.
WDQI, boy, sounds like a radio station. Just to be clear, this is WLOB.
Yes.
But this we're talking about is WDQI.
Exactly.
Tell us about that.
So what we've been doing at the Department of Labor and the Department of Education, we received a grant jointly 3 years ago, and in working with the Maine University system and the Maine Community College system, we have been collecting data on graduates when they come out or when they complete their degree. It could be a certificate program. It could be a post-degree certificate program. It could be a degree program. And looking at their employment rates, how many are employed, and how far out does it show up for them to come? How many quarters out does it take for them to show up in the wage records? And it's a really interesting program for parents and students in high school who are thinking about choosing colleges. You know, what are the different degree programs? Who's graduating more people? Whose groups tend to have higher wages when they come out? Because we can show you the average first-year wages and average quarterly wages. But we also can show it to employers so employers can see what programs are putting out a lot of certain majors, certain certifications, and we as policymakers can evaluate training programs and figure out where we're getting the best bang for our buck, where we're underserved, where we're not putting out enough majors for certain occupations or industries.
And where is this information being housed and how can people access it?
It's on the CWRI website. So if you went to maine.gov/labor/CWRI, and then on their homepage, you can click employment outcomes, or you can do maine.gov/labor/CWRI/WDQI, and that will also take you to the page.
You know what? We're going to put this on the HR Power Hour website so that somebody can just go to hrpowerhour.com, see Julie's face, and right next to it, we'll have all this information for you on how to reach her as well, but we'll make sure that link is on there. It's always funny when we have 7,000 slashes and 200.
It's difficult.
Just how it works. It is.
Yes.
I understand. So where did this idea come from? You know, what has so far been the result of it? How long has it taken?
It's taken about 3 years to put together. This we launched it this summer with the data from the 2009, 10, and 11 graduation classes and degree programs. We are working with the community college system and the University of Maine system to continue to collect that data and make that available. So every year we'll be putting out another set of data. It's a lagging indicator. We're looking at graduation statistics, and then we're matching it to first-year employment and quarterly wage earnings. So it takes about, obviously, a year to get the average first-year income, and then a couple quarters beyond that to get the data downloaded, cleaned up, all those other kinds of things.
So you're using the university system. Is there any information coming from private sector and
private
colleges?
That's the next step, where we want to integrate all the private colleges who want to be a partner in this. I think it's to their benefit to be able to have their graduation rates and earnings of their students aggregated in this. It is confidential. We suppress any graduate numbers lower than 10 so that you can't identify any individual from this. So you say, oh, I know someone who graduated in 2011 from such and such a program. You won't be able to individually single them out.
No, that's good. Well, I think it's an interesting idea because it does help provide what I would find is useful data for not only employers,
is.
But for individuals and families that want to know how this current employment line or whatever they're looking to do might be helpful later in terms of what they're going to earn.
Yeah, what are you going to earn versus what your student loan debt might be? This is a good indicator. We joke, kids watch on TV people making a lot of money. You know, they watch things like the Kardashians, and they're not necessarily out there watching them do work, so to speak, and have an unrealistic expectation of what their initial earnings are going to be once they graduate. And this can give kind of a reality check for certain individuals in certain majors. And if you want to hold out for that major that's a little bit higher income, you can see what the income would actually be for your peers. Now, some people say if you're commuting to USM, you may have a part-time job and you may already have wages, where if you are on campus at UMaine and you don't have a job while you're in school, you might not show wages as quickly as the other person. So there's some variations in the data, but the farther we get out, that's where we're going to see the value when we compare, 5 years out, 10 years out.
Is this a state or federal effort?
This is a state effort. There's several states that already have these systems. Florida is one. Mississippi is another. Mississippi's is so comprehensive that they can drill down and see and tell you how many students are majoring in certain things. If you need certain number of engineers in a certain area, you as an employer can talk to Mississippi and they can tell you not only this is how many we've graduated, but this is how many we have in the pipeline studying for those certain degrees.
Well, that would be incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
When you do think of trends, when organizations need people, that would be great to be able to know what's coming up for
planning,
the pipeline.
Future planning.
Well, strategic planning is a big deal right now because obviously with the shift in demographics, we're seeing a lot of people needed in the marketplace.
Yes.
There's no question about that today.
And we're hearing that more and more from employers, as I'm sure that you guys know.
Yeah, no question about that. All right. Well, we've talked about the WDQI, and now we're going to talk a little about some of the upcoming legislation that's in the process. So let's talk about the first one that is here on the list, as we say. It is an act to update Maine's law to conform to new OSHA regulations. Why would we have to conform to new OSHA regulations in terms of the sense of, isn't that automatic?
Well, for the private sector, you have to conform to new OSHA regulations. For the public sector employers, which the state has enforcement and regulatory authority over, so your counties, your municipalities, your school systems, the university system, and so forth, they have to our state law mirrors the OSHA regulations. They made particular changes. Mostly what this bill deals with is the OSHA record-keeping changes. So for the private sector, you need to know that OSHA has changed their record-keeping rules. That went into effect January 1st of this year. And so we offer free classes and training for those. If you go to safetyworksmaine.com and click on the training, you can see our upcoming schedule about those if you're in the private sector. Some industries were not required and are now auto dealerships are one that were not required to keep the OSHA record keeping logs, but now are. And so this is just bringing the public sector in line with that.
So this is simply mostly for the public sector.
So this bill will affect the public sector.
And this is Bill 26 MRSA.
Yes, it's under Title 26. And in the private sector is already under these rules as of earlier this year.
Okay, that's fine. So it's clarification. It does not change the Bureau's existing authority regarding the right of access. The verbiage is just a change to match OSHA's verbiage and reflect current authority.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. That seems like a no-brainer.
It should not be controversial.
It should not be. Well, and so something non-controversial. What a wonderful thing.
Most of our bills are not very controversial, but once in a while they are. And then a lot of them that affect us that other entities put in are the ones that are a little more controversial, yes.
No problem. We're talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor. We're talking about the 127th legislative season and a whole bunch of DOL bills that are going into effect or actually going in to be discussed. DOL Bill number 2, an act to clarify the laws governing the Bureau of Rehabilitation Services.
This is another internally focused bill where we're just cleaning up some legislation and we're not we're taking out references to programs that are no longer existing and then bringing the language in it to be updated to reflect the current structure of the federal oversight for the vocational rehabilitation program that's part of the Department of Labor, as well as the correct naming of the entities in the law.
Okay. There is a part here that says reducing the number of members on the Commission for the Deaf, Hard of Hearing, and Late Deaf from 24 regular and 3 members at large to 23 members. Why is that significant?
We've had a harder time, I think, filling some of the positions that have been on such a large commission because a lot of the members of that community are they serve and then they term off. It's just really making things more efficient.
Okay, no problem.
And eliminating vacancies.
Yeah, well, we like eliminating vacancy and redundancy. It's a good thing. All right, and the next one would be DOL Bill Number 3, an act to clarify filing methods for quarterly payroll reports.
So this is an interesting bill. If you are an employer and you've been filing your withholding and your state unemployment taxes through the state system, particularly online, and then you would get a bill from MRS that would be both for your unemployment and for your withholding taxes. Those bills are now going to be separated. This was something initiated by Maine Revenue, and we had to conform our statutes to match the changes that Maine Revenue made. The changes are largely already in place for the 2015 reporting year. So what you will see is that your unemployment billing will be separate and your unemployment taxes, if you owe anything or if you have a fine or you have back taxes you owe or you pay, say you owed similar, you know, you had some back issues on MRS and you would send the check in. MRS, because they received the check, they would apply everything to the MRS bill and whatever was left to the unemployment bill. This will actually be better for employers because you might have combined the payments for the principal but not the interest and said, I'll pay the interest next month. But all that money went to the interest in any potential penalties over on the MRS side and never got in the that balance never got applied on the UI side, and then we're giving you more penalties and interest because you haven't paid your unemployment bill.
Well, I can see anything that makes it clear what exactly somebody is going to be paying for,
yes,
and be recording for makes sense.
Right. And there, this bill could be confused to be, say, less business friendly because we're splitting the billing and sending you two separate bills, so you have to write two separate checks as an employer, but you are paying the bill directly to one or directly to the other, and there's not going to be any more of this. Oh, well, we're going to withhold this and pay it and apply it over here, and then you think what you paid over to unemployment went against that, and it wasn't the case.
Can people pay electronically? Does it have to
yes.
be by check?
Nope, they pay online. In fact, we encourage you to pay online. And the confusing thing that I will say about this is you're still going to be paying to Maine Revenue. They're still collecting the tax, but you will pay it separately, and that way it's the accounting is clean.
Okay.
So, yeah, okay. That's my challenge for messaging.
Yes. Yes, that sounds...
We're making it clearer,
yes,
but,
you
still pay to the same
but
person.
But you pay to the same. Okay. All right, I'm going to withhold comment on that one. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by cmacareer.com. And today we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor. We're talking about the 127th Legislative Session, a summary of DOL, Department of Labor, bills. Julie, again, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we've gone through the first three.
Yep.
DOL proposals yep. here. The first one is, the fourth one here is an act to modify unemployment insurance successor law. And I guess the reason for the proposed legislation is that the bill is to offer potential buyers of businesses a choice that currently exists only for business purchased through bankruptcy that was free and clear of liens.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me a little bit about this and how this works.
So if you are purchasing a business that's out of bankruptcy, that's free and clear of the liens, the law in Maine allows the employer the option of assuming the existing experience rate of the business or the new employer rate, whichever is lower. So they have a benefit that existing successorship purchases that don't fall into that bankruptcy category have. So we're looking to extend that to other businesses. So the proposal in this bill would modify the current treatment of business acquisition for the unemployment tax rate in successorship situations where no common ownership or management existed between the purchaser and the seller.
Well, that actually sounds like a pretty easy and common sense law. Or change, I should say, in this particular case.
Yeah, I mean, the experience rating and the problems that employers and the confusion around the experience rating in successorships when you're purchasing a business and what we can disclose to you beforehand, there's a lot of controversy around that. So if we can simplify it and have the option of you starting clean with the new employer rate, which in a lot of cases you are the new employer, then that, I think, would go a long way to make a lot of businesses happier.
Well, you've already got a lot going on when you're purchasing a business.
Yes.
If you could have some certainty into what you were going to be paying or looking at in terms of your unemployment costs, I think that would make sense. And it doesn't seem to be a lot of controversy with this, I would think. But is there?
Well, we're not anticipating that there will be a lot of opposition to the bill. I think we would see, obviously, commercial realtors would likely be in support of this. I think it would, you know, be a boon to people who are looking at buying and purchasing an existing business. So we're hoping that this gets through. Without much difficulty.
Without too much difficulty, sure. All right, Bill number 5, an act to simplify employer substance abuse testing requirements. Employers have had substance abuse testing policies that can provide a safer workplace for their employees. Unfortunately, the current process for implementing a substance abuse testing policy in Maine is cumbersome, complicated, and costly for employers. There is no question about that. I hear from employers all the time that are coming into the state of Maine, and unless they have federal testing, mm-hmm. and they can obviously bypass that testing in terms of it and not use the state plan, they scratch their heads and they are saying, why can't we just do basic testing for either cause or employment? And the state of Maine has such crazy rules for drug testing that
they're an outlier. In many respects.
Well, I mean, there's no question that I understand the purpose. I get it. But they are so restrictive that you cannot even test for cause for the first time something happens. It's the craziest thing.
Right. And you cannot also implement, which is allowed under federal testing, just blanket testing after an accident.
Right.
So that just no matter what the accident is,
you just
do testing. That would not be allowed under Maine's current law.
Does that make any sense to you?
No, which is why last session we attempted to do some reforms of the drug testing statute, and those did not pass. What we did this summer then was we went and we did a survey monkey survey of not only all our existing employers who do drug testing, but we also publicized it to through many different avenues for any business to participate. It was one response per business. That was the only restriction on it. Also, insurance companies and organizations interested in drug use and legalization and substance abuse. So there was from the medical marijuana side to the legalization of marijuana side to organizations that treat to labor unions to all kinds of businesses were represented in this survey. And it's the feedback from that survey that we have used to draft the legislation For this session. And we think that because we have that feedback, it will be a stronger case.
So what is this new proposal do differently? What are some of the things that are part of the changes that are being recommended?
There's a list of several items, so I'll just kind of run down them. It's going to remove the requirement that employers do their own written policy. We're going to offer downloadable policies just to simplify the system. And then employers can use that to update their existing policies. We're going to suggest that we expand the number of establishments that can take company-wide random substance testing from those with only over 50 employees now to organizations with 10 or more. There was a lot of feedback in that survey from those smaller employers that said we can maintain appropriate confidentiality. We have to do it in a lot of ways.
That's
anyway,
like 95% of the main employers.
It is. It is. And that
right?
was
it
a problem.
Of course. It's-
that was a big problem in a big complaint in the survey. We're going to remove the requirement that employers pay for half of the rehab costs that were not covered by health insurance. That was
a major issue.
And it is a big deterrent as to why more employers are not participating, because the what if anticipated cost is just says I'm not doing this.
Absolutely.
We suggest that we eliminate the requirement that an employer has an employee assistance program. That's another major cost factor for the smallest employers. You know, some businesses choose to have it. They see a value in it. Certainly the largest employers, almost all of them have it because it is a benefit that they can then afford. The use rates of those programs versus the costs, that's a very high ratio of cost to use. And we believe that eliminating that requirement would allow more people to test. We are going to clarify the rules about the federal testing versus the state testing. And what do you do if you have to federal test some employees and state test, and you want to state test other employees? We tried to fix that in the 125th, and I think it further confused things rather than simplified things. We're going to expand the definition of probable cause so that you can test after the first incident, and that's a big thing.
That's if nothing else, that if that passes alone, that would be wonderful.
Well, and that's where we are the only state. We're the only state with the half the rehab cost, and we're the only state that bans the first probable cause.
Those two things are the biggest things that employers just shake their head at.
And then the rest of things are mostly cleanup. Like, we're going to get rid of the clause around nuclear power plants and testing because Maine doesn't have any more of those.
I understand. Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense, and I think... What's the feeling right now in the legislature?
Well, I mean, it's hard to see right now. LCRED is just getting started. They've been having hearings the past couple weeks. We, as a department, have done, under Susan Wasserod, our legislative director, we've had a presentation. The commissioner went to LCRED and took several of the bureau directors and senior staff that would be the people likely testifying on bills or being the subject matter experts during work sessions, so that LCRED could kind of get a sense of them face to face. And we also had them come and tour the Augusta Career Center to talk about our programs that run out of the career centers and things like rapid response during layoffs. So we think we've set the tone to the start of the session very positively, and we know that there's a lot of bills coming down the pike, but we want to work with them to make the law better and better, more enforceable.
Okay. So the next bill is DOL 6, an act to correct verbiage in the procedures for the Industry Partnership Grant Program.
This is really just a cleanup bill because there's some language that's not grammatically correct, I guess. And so when you read it and try to act out what the bill asks you to do, you can't quite do it the way that it's written. And this would be for the work that we're doing in workforce development that the commissioner spoke about when she was on with you a couple weeks ago, in terms of preparing Maine's workforce for the future, how we evaluate proposals that industries or employers bring to us, and how we work together with our other departments, Department of Education and Department of Economic and Community Development and DHHS going forward.
How do you see this really helping businesses?
We want to make sure that we're training for the jobs that the businesses are hiring in. So that's a critical part of this. We also want to make sure that we're giving workers, when they do the training, whether it's an on-the-job training or something that's in partnership with a community college or adult ed or another private sector training provider, that they're getting what we call an industry recognized credential that they could take to another employer and get a job with, or build upon it with another degree or another certification. I know that employers are always worried that they're going to invest money in training and then the worker is going to leave. And I think the challenge that we face with our demographic issue and our shrinking workforce going into the future is really how are you going to retain your workers as well as find the workers. So I think the employers will be looking for any way that they can retain those workers and finding ways that the state can partner with them to train those workers, keep them with them, help them move up the line and have those skills to help that business grow and be competitive is really going to be a benefit to the
state.
Yeah,
no, I do think that this is certainly an area where employers are looking for some assistance right now. There's no question about it.
Right. And we need to make sure as we look at our training programs, you know, coming out of the recession, there were a lot of people who were looking for work and may have had the initiative to go out and get trained on their own or to come to the department and participate in one of our training programs. Now we're starting to look a little harder for those people. Some of those individuals might not have the skill level. They may need to do a little pre-work before they can get into that training program. And so we're trying to find those pathways to get people skilled up, whether it's literacy or numeracy, working with DOE and adult ed to get them prepared to go into that training. We call that ready to work, and we've got some initiatives around that
at
the department.
That's great. You're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Julia Rabinowitz. She's the Director of Communications and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor, and we will be right back on News Talk WLLB. Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
If you'd like to be a guest on the HR Power Hour or be a show sponsor, send David an email today at info@hrpowerhour.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLLB and presented by cmacareer.com. Today, we are talking with Julia Rabinowitz. She is the director of the Department of Labor's Communications and Operations Department. And we are having too much fun talking about the 127th legislative session and some of the DOL bills that are coming out there. How are we having fun?
We're having a great time.
We're having a great time. Look, folks, these things affect you. And I know some of you may be going, more bills, really? But they're important, and some of this stuff really is helpful. So pay attention. All right, we're going to talk about DOL Act Number 7, an act to conform Maine law to federal law regarding closings and mass layoffs and strengthen employee severance pay protections.
Now, normally we don't really get into severance pay. It's really in these large closings of 100 or more employees. And as you know, we were just talking about, you know, there's not a lot of employers in Maine that kind of reach that threshold. But the severance Act did come into play in the Bucksport Verso paper mill closing. And we, as the department, did have to take enforcement action there. Rather than enforce the fine and things like that, what we did is we ended up, with the governor's approval, negotiating with Verso to come to an agreement, basically a payment plan, because we had some controversy between what the collective bargaining agreement called for in a severance action versus what state law was, what was enforceable under state law. And we came to a compromise that basically allowed Verso to pay the payment in two parts and not incur any fines. But it made sure that we didn't have to take Verso to court, and the workers got the severance pay much faster than they would have had we had to take enforcement actions.
Severance pay isn't required under law.
It's required when the company is closing or leaving town. And it's unless you meet the provisions of this, the severance pay is a negotiable thing, you know, between you and your employees.
So if a company goes bankrupt and they're leaving because they're out of business and there isn't any money, how do you pay severance?
Well, there was and this is the complication of the law. Under the current law, you don't have to pay severance. And if you file for bankruptcy, if you filed for Chapter 7. Mm-hmm. And so that was amended in 2009 to allow that. Well, what would happen is if you're going to close, you just file Chapter 7. You slide it around, whether it's you or your parent company or whatever it happens to be. And we found that the severance pay provision was not effective. You know, the Verso closure was short notice. It was a lot of people, and it was people, 70% of those workers were over the age of 50, and the severance pay is
a big piece of their retirement.
And that's really what this bill, those kinds of situations, is what this bill is
designed to target. So is the legislative bill targeted towards specifics more than general, or how will it affect, overall, will it require, for example, private employers to have to pay severance?
It will require them to pay severance if they meet these conditions of size and the type of closure in the notice that's given. So if you're closing because of a physical, you know, hurricane or whatever, you know, something closes your business down, that's not going to be a severance situation. It's more that the employer is shutting down, picking up, and moving out lock, stock, and barrel, leaving in the middle of the night, those kinds of things.
So if an employer leaves to go out of state because they decide to go to a right-to-work state, for example, mm-hmm. if that happens,
right.
will that then trigger this?
It could. It could if they have enough employees.
Enough employees.
And have been in. And it's not every employee. The employee has to be with a company 3 years or more. And there's some rules about how we calculate that and how we look at that severance pay piece. I think that this will be controversial because of the recent situation in Bucksport. And in those situations, there's no good way to make everybody happy, because in the end, even if you get the severance pay, you still lost your job.
Absolutely. This it's a no-win.
Right.
There's a no-win. Right. It kind of cushions the blow, but that's about it. You're absolutely right. All right, the next bill would be DOL 8, an act to encourage great efficiency in the unemployment insurance system. Isn't that an oxymoron, efficiency in the unemployment insurance
system? Well, you know, we are working harder and harder, and I know it can sound like a platitude, but, you know, we started off the hour talking about some of the improvements we're making with technology in the unemployment system. Ever since the governor's Blue Ribbon Commission and the report from USDOL, and I know that when the commissioner was here, you guys talked about some of those changes that we've implemented, we have been looking at ways to improve that system. Another project we're working on right now is what we call the consortium, and we're working to upgrade the entire technology backbone for both unemployment benefits and tax to a cloud-based system that is currently a state-of-the-art system that Mississippi is using, and they built from scratch. And we, Rhode Island and Mississippi, would be the first partners in this, and that would be going into transition in 2016-2017. And so that will bring a lot of efficiencies to the way we run the program behind the scenes. This bill is looking at efficiencies in the appeals process. A lot of the recommendations are coming out of things we have learned about our system compared to the way other states do their system in the wake of the Blue Ribbon Commission report. And this would be both an efficiency in terms of the streamlining the way the Unemployment Assurance Commission reviews cases and is structured. It would also save taxpayer money.
Great. Love saving taxpayer money.
Yes.
All right. DOL number 11, an act to conform Maine law to federal law and simplify the work permitting process for minors.
So once again, we're going at
say,
it.
This sounds vaguely familiar.
For all the past sessions, we have tried to do some implementing of reforms to the work permit system and to take a look at what our laws are preventing minors from doing in terms of employment that are allowed in other states and are allowed under federal law. So we would not be exposing children to hazards that are unique to Maine and letting them, you know, run amok in the streets and work in, you know, weaving looms and equipment from 100 years ago. But what we would be doing is opening up more opportunities for work. We once again are going to try for movie theaters and bowling alleys and a couple other occupations.
Why has this been so difficult?
It was kind of shocking, the debate on the floor that came from some of the Democratic legislators saying that the bill we had last year to put the work permit system online to allow the superintendents to not have to be signing permits in the summer when they're away on vacation and making kids wait to get their work permit and get to work, making employers wait because the employers can't hire them until they have the permit. That kids were going to lose their fingers in bowling alleys and kids were going to lose their fingers in movie theaters. I mean, kids these days see a lot worse than what's in your movie theater on their cell phone. And the things they're going to be doing at bowling alleys is, you know, clean up and running birthday parties. The bowling alleys today are not the bowling alleys of the 60s.
They most certainly are not. You know, I always find it fascinating. Maine has always allowed some younger workers to do things. Like, for example, they used to be able to drive the tractors. They probably still do when they're really young. That's why you had a driver's license.
Right, the agricultural work, yes.
Right, you could get your driver's license at 15 in Maine, which is just not something you can everywhere.
You can work on a lobster boat.
Absolutely, you work on a lobster boat. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me why this has been such a controversial thing.
Right, and I think it's just the idea that we're trying to open it up, and we're not, in the irony is that the parent has to sign the work permit. So the kid cannot go out and get a job in something that the parent does not support, because the job has to be, you have to have an offer of the job from the employer, the title of the position has to be on that permit, and the parent and the superintendent have to sign it.
I mean, it allows minors 16 and 17 years of age to work as late as 11 rather than 10-15. That seems kind of like 10-15 is kind of an odd time.
Well, you know, if your shift ends at 10 and then you've got to punch out and go up and take off your jacket and get out. I mean, kids are staying up later. The
no
kids
question.
Who want to work should be afforded the opportunity to work. And the irony is that they're up at basketball practice. They're getting up for ice time for hockey. For practices
I know most of the
at 5 in the morning.
5 in the morning. They're going to like 7, 8, 9 at night in some
right.
of these practices.
And, so, you know, to say that so we think those kids are going to bed at 8, you know, 16-year-old high school kids to get up at 5. So, you know, I think that we can be a little more modern in the way that we're looking at our youth employment regulations.
No, that makes a lot of sense. We're talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She is the Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we've been talking with Julie Rabinowitz. She's the Director of Communication and Operations for the Maine Department of Labor. We've been going over a ton of new DOL legislative bills that are coming up that we're going to be talking a lot about. So, you know, one of the things that I know is a hot button issue, and certainly that has been talked about quite a bit, locally and at the state level, heck, even at the federal level, is the minimum wage bills. My understanding is there are 5 to 6 that are potentially coming to the floor.
Yes.
So tell me about where the DOL sits on this. Tell me about what the, you know, the administration is looking at this. What's going on with the DOL and having to do with the minimum wage?
Well, there's several legislators who have put in bills that have a minimum wage provision. We have not, as a department or the governor's office, have put in a minimum wage bill. So they're not coming from our side of the government. But they propose various different increases in the $8 ranges and the $9 ranges and the 10-10 is what the feds have talked about. The president has talked about 10-10 and the Secretary of Labor, Perez, has talked about 10-10. What we are looking at the department is at the minimum wage from a different perspective. And we also have been looking at it for some of the municipalities that are proposing it. We could talk about that in a second.
Sure.
What's our economy doing right now? Where is the minimum wage standing? And what are we going to be seeing going forward? Right now in Maine, there's only about 20,000 people, we estimate, who are being paid minimum wage. A good proportion of those, in fact, more than half, are people under the age of 24, which means they're high school students, they're college students, so likely they're working part-time, and they are not, for the most part, in those age categories, supporting themselves and or a family on a minimum wage job. The vast majority of minimum wage workers are working part-time. There's only about 3,000 people who are working full-time in a minimum wage job who are older than 24. For those workers, giving them a raise in the minimum wage would be a raise for them, but the reason that's most likely why they're in the minimum wage full-time job is because of education and skills. And we believe that raising the minimum wage does not increase those individuals' skills. And for employers, which is the difficulty, if they do have to make choices for how many people they are employing based on the increase in the wage, the person who's going to get cut is the person with the least amount of skills. They're the person who needs the job the most.
There is no question that this issue has really become more about a living wage than a minimum wage.
Right. And the living wage, you know, the average wage in Maine is in the $12 to $13 an hour range. And when we are doing our training programs, we want to train people for higher than average than the state average wage. So we're always looking to train people for the $14 and $15 an hour kinds of jobs at minimum as a starting coming out of training. You know, but our economy has a large number of retail and hospitality jobs due to the tourism industry.
Service industry.
We are that kind of economy in the summer. So a lot of people take those part-time minimum wage jobs as a supplement to their main income. And they're not what's putting bread on the table, but is actually maybe saving money for the summer vacation or something else.
A lot of towns locally, cities, have started talking about having their minimum wage raise. We've talked about certainly Portland, being one that's all over the news.
Yes.
And I know it's been delayed slightly in terms of a decision on that. What is the risk of a city or town actually taking that on versus allowing the state to make it across the board?
Well, you know, during the campaign, what the governor's position was that if the federal government raised the minimum wage, then that would have a level playing field for all states to then decide whether or not they wanted to raise it beyond that. But it would create a level playing field for towns surrounding a municipality that raises the minimum wage. Then the question is, how do we enforce that if the company is based in the town, but the workers don't work there? They like home health care. Does the worker get paid the minimum wage because of the P.O. box of the business is in the town with the higher minimum wage, but really they never even go to that town. They work the next county over and cover an area of 20 towns. Those are the kind of jurisdictional questions that make it difficult. For those cities or municipalities that choose to increase the minimum wage, they will have to take on the enforcement responsibilities of that increase from the state. We cannot enforce municipal law as the State Department of Labor. We can only enforce state law. In fact, when it gets to jurisdictional issues over minimum wage, USDOL will turn cases over to us for pay, because we enforce a higher rate of pay than the feds do. So when it gets to matters of jurisdiction, if we were called into a Portland or a Bangor to enforce final paychecks, we could only enforce the state minimum wage.
It makes it a lot more cumbersome. And enforcement is interesting because I'm not sure how a city is going to enforce somebody outside of their jurisdiction to do anything.
Well, they would have to hire wage and hour inspectors. They would duplicate then what we have at the state level, and they would also need to have a mechanism to take those employers to court to make them
And I'm
pay.
Sure all the cities and towns have plenty of money to hire more inspectors.
Well, I think those are the hidden costs, right? Right. You know, there's several hidden costs. Now, a municipality the size of San Francisco, they already have a lot of municipal employees.
Sure.
For cities the size of Bangor and Portland, is not a parallel case.
Well, Julie, thank you very much today for being on the show. You've provided us a great overview of what's going to be happening in 2015 with the 127th legislative session.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being on. And now the HR tip of the week. 4 essential characteristics of 21st century leadership. This is on trendhr.com. To thrive in today's fast-changing business environment, there are 4 key 21st century leadership requirements you must have. First, the capacity to navigate. These skills allow leaders to scan the consistently shifting landscape for signals, patterns, and trends that may impact their company's ability to grow. 2, the capacity to empathize. Leaders need the ability to reach people who are different from themselves. 3, the capacity of self-correct. Self-correcting has to do with understanding that a practice or behavior that worked well in the past may not be effective today. And then 4, the capacity to set up a win-win proposition for stakeholders. Leaders must embrace the increased transparency and competition wrought by rapid information flows. We are seeing a broader array of stakeholders with non-governmental organizations, labor unions, community organizations, bloggers, and many others joining the traditional network of customers, suppliers, and employees. Are you ready for 21st century leadership requirements? Can you fill these 4 needs? That's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, we're going to be speaking with our good friend Rick Dacry, president of Dacry Associates. He's a recognized workforce expert management consultant and national speaker on employment law and organizational issues. He also has a book, Uncomplicating Management, Focus on Your Stars and Your Company Will Soar. We're going to be talking about recruiting trends in today's market. We're going to be talking about ways that you can hire and retain great talent. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.